Mother Teresa has a reputation as a great humanitarian, but is it justified? Welcome to The Conquering Truth. I'm Dan Horn.
I'm Roger Bootin.
I'm Charles Churchill.
And I'm Joshua Horn.
So Mother Teresa is considered one of the great humanitarians of the 20th century. She received a Nobel Prize, I think, in 1979 for her work in bringing help to suffering humanity. So something like in 1950s, she was trained as a nun. She gets sent to be a teacher in India. She sees the poor. She decides to commit her life to the poor. She ends up setting up a bunch of not hospitals, although people accused her of saying she did that later, but more like hospices, places for people to die, is what she set up. So she resolved that she would provide care for them and make it so that they wouldn't die on the streets, that they'd die in these homes that she set up. And then her missionaries of charity became very big. It ended up having like 4,500 nuns in it, $100 million a year in funding. And so she ends up receiving a Nobel Prize. And so she became world renowned. But was that really justified?
Yeah, I think it's probably fair to say that she's one of the most revered figures of the last century. You know, there, even among pretty sound Christians, would say, well, you know, Mother Teresa, there's the Catholic Church, perhaps, you know, they're not Christian, but you know, you have people in it like Mother Teresa that are really doing good work and seem to really love God. And you know, I didn't know a ton about Mother Teresa, and when I started research for the podcast, I was like, okay, so there's some articles for her, some against her. And I actually read the articles, and I was surprised at how awful a lot of the stuff was. And you know, it's from multiple levels. I mean, it's just from humanitarian level, from honesty, doctrine. We're Protestants. We're not bashing her simply because she's Roman Catholic, but it will come up. And financial mismanagement or worse. So it's just a lot of different things. And we're not just trying to attack people because they're famous or attack her because she's famous, because she's well-regarded, but because there's actual serious issues and serious issues that aren't just historical things, but that they are ongoing today, that it's not Mother Teresa anymore, but it's someone new and it's someone that you might be giving to. And this is a good example of how to exercise discernment. It's something that people failed at in previous years, that she was not exposed in the way that she should have been during her lifetime.
And I mean, we've done podcasts on Voice of the Martyrs, and it's the same thing. People think that they've given money that's going overseas, so therefore they're helping people overseas. It's actually really hard to successfully help people overseas. As a church, we've provided something like 600 legs to people in Nigeria. And it's hard. It's hard to control it. It's hard to do the finances for it. Everything pushes against it because these nations are so corrupt. And what's really easy for people to do is go, I wrote a check, I'm fine. And so Mother Teresa gets pumped up and she gets famous and she gets world renowned, even though she doesn't deserve it in a lot of ways. But it's because people just want to say, okay, I've taken care of the poor, I've written my check. And so since they're getting the satisfaction out of that, nobody wants to check and say, wait a second, what's really happening?
I mean, it's really, like you're saying, it's hard for us. It's easy for us at times to let money become the thing that's going to solve the problem. And not like in a sense of there are times where you can supply something like a leg, but there's other times where just the weight, like you said, there's so many different, there's infrastructure that has to be put in place to do that. And in that, there are people who are coming in and trying to take advantage of that. And you can be doing great harm to them while you're trying to do something helpful. So you end up helping this person down here, maybe legitimately, and hurting 20 people in between. And it's very, very easy to do that. And I think people underestimate both the nature of sin. They underestimate how easy it is to actually help someone. I think that'll come up as we go through the episode. But this is part of the reason for doing this, is both to go, it's very easy to venerate someone in a very wrong way and to look at them very wrongly. And it's also very easy to think wrongly about what we think of as good works.
But I think it goes to our human nature to want to, like you were describing, Dan, sort of take that guilt off of ourselves and say, and so if you think of all the different charities, you think of, you know, the Salvation Army at Christmas time, or Jerry Lewis Telethon,
right.
You know, that would be,
Muscular used to be on,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah. was on every year. Like this is how charities are successful. How they raise so much money is because everybody's looking for a way to say, oh, okay, I did, kind of pat themselves on the back and say, I did my part. I can go on. I don't have to worry about it. I don't have to really do anything because I already gave this check. And it's a way to sort of remove that guilt and feel good about ourselves without actually doing something.
And a lot of charities think the same way, or a lot of people think the same way, as though there's all kinds of regulations about, you know, financial, you have to do, you know, tax returns and all these other things. So there's all this kind of monitoring. And what they don't realize is as soon as you change it to another currency, it all goes away. Nobody watches anything. And so it's very easy to steal. It's very easy to redirect money. It's very, because all the U.S. government is looking is just to the border where it goes into another currency, because then they go, okay, it's out of our realm. It's out of our responsibility. So when they do that auditing and stuff, it's not real audits when you go overseas, because they can fake everything.
And what I read is that because her organization, it was an order of nuns, was based in India. And what I read is that they never filed the financial disclosures that they were supposed to file.
Nor did they register. So after a while, they lost their registration. They refused to re-register.
And you know, but of course, she's one of the most famous people in the world. And so there's a big incentive not to come after her, especially when you're the Indian government and, you know, you need the help in a way, and she's well connected. So, you know,
and
she gets
guaranteed with the amount of money that was flowing through her. It's so easy to bribe people in those situations. There's no way that she couldn't just have them overlook it. I mean, it's trivial in those countries. Probably not as hard as I think it is in the United States, but in countries like that, it is trivial. There's everybody with a handout, and you could get anything filed whenever you want, however you want. And you know, she knows they're not going to come after her. And if they actually tried to, she'd give 0.00001% of the money, and it would be taken care of.
So I think it is fair to mention kind of at the outset that there are reasons that people could look at her and be pretty sympathetic. One of those would be that the enemies she had during her lifetime were the right enemies to have. The biggest people, at least in the most detail that I'm aware of, that were coming after her were Christopher Hitchens, you know, one of the most militant atheists in the world. And part of the reason he was coming after her, I'm sure, is because she was one of the highest profile Christians by name. And if he could take her down, that's a big strike against God. And so, you know, that's a good enemy to have. Another one is, you know, radical Hindus did not like her at all. But just because someone has the right enemies doesn't mean that they're good. And just that, you know, you have to look at the evidence, and you can't look at personalities and say this person's a Christian and the atheists are against her, so we're on the Christian side. Listen to what they have to say. You take it with a grain of salt, but look at the evidence, look at the responses, see what people have, and see where the truth is. And the other thing is, she did take stands on some issues where, you know, that were biblical, like abortion, probably the most notable example, where she is, you know, being vocal about the Catholic Church's traditional teaching that abortion's wrong. And that's another reason why Christopher Hitchens came after her, because he, you know, and then the liberal Hindus came after her because they liked abortion. They wanted babies to be killed. And so they didn't like that she was against that. But the jihadists don't like homosexuality doesn't mean that we're pro-jihadists. So you have to look at the whole thing. You don't get a pass just because you're right on important issues. Where to be fair, you know, the evangelical church was largely failing at times when she was speaking out.
Right. And I mean, Ronald Reagan used her to try to fight against abortion while he was president. And so that's a lot of the things that she was doing in the United States. And she knew where she was getting her money from. I think that she was we shouldn't consider her an innocent party in this, that she knew where she was getting her money. She was getting it from the Catholics and from the evangelicals. And so her profile in the United States, one of the large parts of her profile in the United States was fighting abortion, which is going to get the evangelicals to give money to her organizations. But if you step back, and I said in the introduction that, you know, that she gets awards for helping the poor, but that isn't really what she started to do. That wasn't her main focus. Her main focus was to help people die. that's what she set up her hospices for. That's probably the most accurate term. Was she goes to Calcutta, like one of the probably the greatest density of poverty at the time in the world. So you have to give her credit that she didn't like go to like someplace easy. She did go to a hard place to go to, and she all saw all these people dying on the streets, and she decided they shouldn't die on the streets.
And there's something, there's a point where that's appropriate. It is good to give, to pay respect to people, poor people, and give them some care as they're dying. And, but if you thought that there was more that she was doing than that, it's probably because she said she was doing more than that. And she would talk about how we have this hospital with thousands of people in it. And then the people in Calcutta are like, you don't have a hospital with thousands of people in it. She says, we have an orphanage with thousands of people. They're like, you don't have an orphanage with thousands of people in it. And you know, that's kind of hard to get around. Is she's claiming to do things she wasn't doing. And it's all well and good to say, I have this charity that I'm doing that's restricted, and I don't do everything in the world, because you can't do everything in the world when you have limited resources.
But she had pretty much unlimited resources.
Yeah. Or at least much less.
Well, in India, they were pretty much unlimited resources. Sure. I mean, if she's making $100 million a year in collections, that's really, really, really hard to spend.
That goes really far in India.
She, at her dinner, she demanded that they canceled the dinner for receiving the Nobel Prize because it was going to cost $7,000. And she said, just give that to me and I'll feed 200 Indians for a year for that money. Well, I'm sorry, for the amount of money that she had, the $7,000 was nothing compared to what she was raising, like nothing. And yet she makes this big thing about it because it was all marketing. But she really wasn't helping the people nearly like she said she was.
Right. Because, we have a prosthetics clinic in Nigeria, and people sometimes email us with sad stories. But we have to say, we can't help everyone. We have limited resources. We focus on this, on spreading the gospel, on doing prosthetics. We can't verify your story. We can't do this for you. But when you have millions of dollars in your bank account, and there were, people that left her nun convent or order of nuns.
Order of nuns. She was the Mother Supreme, whatever that's called. The
Supreme Mother.
Right.
Mother Superior. That's what it's called.
But which she, when one of them was involved, was in the finance division, she's like, we have millions of dollars in her bank account. And so it's hard to justify not opening a hospital.
If you're saying that you have one,
right? You're letting the money stay, because part of the convent or the order of part of the order of nuns was also like a vow of poverty too. But like, you can't then say we have a vow of poverty, so that means we're just going to leave the money, and like we said, no financial accountability. Who knows where it went? Like, why? Like, and there's accounts of people who could have been saved who were dying, and they're like, no, we. This is a place, this is a hospice place. So just because this person go to a hospital, that's not our job. We're a hospice.
And they were being very specific, as usually for most of the people before they took them in, they would require them to go to a hospital and not be accepted in the hospital. And so they were very deliberate. These are people that cannot receive care, but they had lots of money. They could have paid for their care at hospitals. It's not that that would have been a problem. They just weren't allowed into the hospital because they couldn't pay. And so Mother Teresa says, fine, we'll just bring you into this place. You have something that's curable, but we're not going to do anything except watch you die. That in itself is a very cruel thing. And again, when she started, she didn't have the resources, right? I do get emails all the time, or Facebook messages, whatever they are, about, oh, we need this. This person's dying. If we just had this, if we just had that. And some of them are probably true. And at the same time, the answer is, we don't have the resources. We don't have the money to do that. And so at first it may have been true, but over time she became an international star, an international fundraising star, to put it in more concrete terms. It was never an issue with money. Once she got to that level, it wasn't an issue with money. At first, it could have been sincere that we just can't do anything. But when you read her views, you start to go, there's some problems here.
And I mean, if you're sitting at home and you're trying to think through how this works, the answer is if you're not going, if someone came to us and said, we want to give you $1 million to push the legs, we would go, first of all, we would go, we're not taking donations for that. We're not accepting donations, because right now money is not what is actually driving or stopping what we can do. There's limits on what we can do. There's only so much.
It does somewhat.
So. I mean,
or okay, if they're going to give us $100 million, we would say no, thank you.
Right, we cannot.
Yeah, $1 million we might take. $100 million, no, we're not taking
it.
That's
kind of what I mean. Is there's a point where you go, giving me more money? If somebody says we want to give you money to help the poor, and you are not going to use it to help the poor, it is immoral to take it and to pretend like you are using it to help the poor. That is the area where we are saying she really misrepresented things.
And she like took collections for famine in Ethiopia, and then I believe it was the spokesperson for the Order of Nuns said, "We're not sending money to Africa." Like, you, that's just fraudulent.
So is there, do we know what they were doing with it?
Number I've seen that I was able to find was 7% of the money given to them may have gone to the actual people. The other 93% either set in bank accounts or was transferred to the Vatican. And so that the Vatican ended up being the largest recipient of that money. And even I think after her death, I think that's where it all ended up going.
Because I don't think
it continues. It's still going on today. Okay. The missionaries of charity that she started, that continues today.
I thought there was a large part that went to them after her death, but that may be an act.
And I think a large part went all the time.
Okay.
She was an official spokesman of the Vatican. And so, I mean, she could speak for the Vatican. I mean, she was high up in Roman Catholic circles.
Right. There were people who did some level of tracking, and that's where they could find. And basically the most consistent thing I could find is that it stopped, the level of accountability completely stopped once it hit the Vatican. The Vatican would give no further information on where the money they received went or how it was used.
And because we're not saying that she had a massive palace somewhere where the streets were paved in gold.
Right.
You know, I think.
But a lot of probably the last half of her life, she spent very little time in India.
Sure.
The first part of her life she spent, then she was a fundraiser. I mean, she was all over the place. I mean, she was a jet setter. And I'm not saying that she was sitting there collecting huge amounts of money, because I don't think that's true for herself.
You mean for herself.
And so she wasn't doing that. But at the same time, she was meeting, you know, heads of country and stuff. She wasn't like living a impoverished lifestyle. You don't live an impoverished lifestyle and go jetting off someplace every week.
At least from what I saw, there's nothing to say that she wasn't a loyal, you know, servant of the Catholic Church.
Except that her doctrine was pretty anti-Catholic in ways.
That's flexible. You raised enough money. That's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's true. In the Roman Catholic Church, when its real God is money, she was a faithful servant of the Roman Catholic Church. But I mean, you do read, and there were people who went there, and like Fox, who's, I don't think he's the editor of The Lancet anymore, but that's probably one of the most well-known medical publications. He went there and he said that it was pretty clean, but there's other people that went there and the filth that was described by volunteers that went for like 3 months and stuff was like unbelievably bad. And, you know, one of them talked about how they would have the children in there tied to beds and they'd soil themselves and the nuns would laugh at them in their, you know, soiled clothes. They wouldn't clean them up. They just had a hole in the floor that they would sweep the feces and stuff into, and that it was like very, very unsanitary and very filthy. And so there was probably different levels at different places, and the Americans had come in, or the Western Europeans had come in, or the Australians had come in. They see different things than other people who volunteer. And so I think there was some of it was pretty horrific. Now, living on the streets, I mean, to be fair, living on the streets is, yeah, in a lot of ways could have been worse. But at the same time, you shouldn't go that she was trying to alleviate their suffering. Because in a lot of ways, with her view of the world, she didn't see that she should be alleviating suffering.
Right. Because, I mean, there's a podcast that their motto is that bad theology hurts people. Because, and I think that very much applies to her, because she wasn't trying to be sadistic to the people, but she had a view that, you know, suffering It's kind of like how, you know, you had, you know, monks that go through the streets beating themselves on the back. I mean, she had that same mentality that there was a holiness to suffering and it was a good thing to be suffering. And so why would I even take this away from someone when God has given them this opportunity to emulate Christ by suffering, which is not a biblical concept.
And as we talk about that, we should say that in her own words. So this is what Christopher Hitchens said, that, you know, he claimed that this was a quote from her in interviewing her. "There is something beautiful in seeing the poor accept their lot, to suffer it like Christ's passion. The world gains much from their suffering." So when you look at a group of people that are really suffering, and I mean, in Western culture, it's hard for us even to imagine the level of suffering that a lot of these people that were the poor in India at that point, the level that they were suffering just on a day-to-day basis in the West, it's just really hard to even comprehend. But she's like looking at them and not saying, okay, how do we raise these people out of poverty? She's looking at them and saying, wow, I see the passion of Christ in this. I see the Lord suffering when he went to the cross in this, because in the Western world, we don't see this level of suffering. And I can look at this level of suffering, and from that, I can get a feel of who Christ is. And so the world gains much from the suffering. I mean, this is a very, I understand you didn't say it was sadistic, but to me, it sounds pretty sadistic, is that she's taking pleasure because she thinks she's closer to Christ because they're suffering.
It was like cultural
stigma.
And it's
her suffering. It's their suffering, not her suffering.
Right.
As opposed to, you know, like in 1 Peter 2, where it says that when we suffer for his name's sake, we become like him, and that's a blessing to us. That's not that you cause suffering in other people. And she was looking at the other people and say their suffering causes her to be blessed and the world to be blessed.
Right. And I mean,
and they don't even know Christ. So this isn't suffering for the name of Christ, which right. is what it says in 1 Peter 2.
And you want to be fair in the sense that there are times where it would be wrong to take, you know, it would be wrong if you just had the money to come in and go, I'm going to take away your need to work. I'm going to take, you know, I mean, it's, there are places where you would go, the difficulty that people have in life, it's like taking away all your children's difficulties. That would be very bad for your children. That is very different than going, your child is sick and you don't take them to the doctor. Your child gets bit by a snake and you go, well, this poison, you're going to have to deal with the poison that goes through your body, and it might kill you.
But what a glorious thing to see.
Right. And that's literally what she was doing when she would take these poor in and let them die. Some of them had things that could be healed. I mean, they weren't all fatal injuries or fatal diseases unless you didn't treat them. And so she chooses not to treat them instead. I'm sorry. I think that is pretty sadistic.
And some of it is too. I mean, at least at certain points, these nuns that were running these places, they didn't have medical training. I mean, they had resources, but they weren't giving them training. They weren't having them, you know, differentiate between the people that really couldn't be helped and the people that just need to go to the doctor and have their bill paid and they'd be healed.
And I do think that there was no, and she wanted them to suffer at a certain level. And part of this gets to be hard because India at the time, it was illegal to use morphine. And because it was illegal to use morphine, and that's what is the primary, you know, pain reliever that is used in situations with dying. But there is things between morphine and aspirin or acetaminophen, which is all that was the strongest thing that they would give somebody who's dying of cancer. There's cruelty to that when you do have the money for lots of other supplies. But that was the strongest pain reliever that they would
give. Was it opiates or was it just morphine? I mean, was it any opiate?
I don't remember I didn't read that. Okay. I mean, the focus on this was on morphine. The
article. Or how about use your huge public profile to say legalize pain relief in India? Like,
well, and they seemed willing to flaunt the laws in other areas. So, I mean,
they did end up changing the law. I mean, right. and from India's standpoint, they're looking back to the mid 19th century and the opium things that were coming from China and the opium opium dens and the addiction that was in China and affecting that, and they were trying to keep it out of India. But there's, you know, and you could get it too. It just required two doctor signatures. Okay. But usually they never had more than one doctor there, so they could never get two doctor signatures, and it was also hard to administer. I mean, it would be just like a Class A drug in the United States. It's a lot harder to use. which is what morphine is now.
Sure.
So.
Well, and there's just something about that view of the suffering. It's like the, I mean, one, as we pointed out, it's not righteous suffering. They're not suffering for Christ. But it's almost like I get something out of your suffering because I can see more of Christ.
Right.
And it's interesting. It's a very Roman Catholic view because she, at least in that quote that was attributed to her, she said the passion of Christ, because it's the Roman Catholic, I mean, they made the movie The Passion of the Christ, because I think a lot of times a Roman Catholic view is that physical suffering that Christ experienced at the crucifixion was the ultimate thing. And they're not even understanding, you know, it was the wrath of God.
Right. And I mean, I read, and it wasn't a direct quote from her because I didn't put it in here, but I read somebody that reported that basically, I mean, she said, hey, it's good for them. It basically pays part of their purgatory. So they're suffering purgatory now with that suffering. So they'll have less punishment once they get sent to purgatory after their death. And so she's even looking at it saying it's better for them to suffer because they don't want to suffer in purgatory. So just let them suffer now.
It's sort of a universalist view, because how many of these people were actually professing Catholics?
Oh, she argued very strongly against that. So she wrote a book called Life in the Spirit, Reflections, Meditations, and Prayers. We never try to convert those who receive aid from the missionaries of charity to Christianity, but in our work we bear witness to the love of God's presence. And if Catholics, Protestants, Buddhists, or agnostics become for this better men, simply better, we will be satisfied. If that individual thinks and believes that this is the only way to God for her or him, this is the way God comes to their life, his life. If he does not know any other way, and if he has no doubt so that he does not need to search, then this is his way to salvation. And so completely rejects any idea of Christ, any need for Christ. She very much becomes, you know, she has a universalist position. I'm sure she'd take the standard Roman Catholic position, is that everybody's saved except for Protestants, which is in their catechism. And so this isn't that contrary, but she's not even, but people thought, and there's people who did, she did these forced conversions, and there's, she probably did baptize people in their deathbed, these things, you know, do you have these poor people that they have no idea what she's talking about. But mostly what she did is say, you're all going to heaven. It doesn't matter. Just pray to your God. There's even, you know, somebody talked about how somebody asked her, I think this was Christian News that asked her, so what do you say to somebody who's a Hindu or, you know, something else? You know, what should I do when I'm dying? And she said, pray to your God. Not pray to the God, but pray to your God, because it doesn't matter. She doesn't think that, and she thought that the pain would remove your punishment, some of your punishment from purgatory, so it didn't really matter if you believed in Jesus Christ. And so to think that in any way she's a Christian missionary, that's a completely wrong view of who she was.
And, you know, we're talking about some of the other things of not helping where she could have, or having all these funds and not sure where they went. Just on this principle alone of, let's just assume she was helping people, but then just saying, well, just pray to your God. She's giving, in that situation, she'd be giving people maybe some temporary, right, you know, physical help, but spiritually she'd be helping to condemn them.
Right. And so that's definitely what she was doing, is she wasn't giving that much physical help to preserve their life or to care for their life. But at the same time, I mean, she was definitely condemning them spiritually. She didn't care. She didn't care that they were worshiping false gods, that they were idolaters. To her, it was really irrelevant. She just wanted them to be better men. I'm not even sure what that definition is when you take God out of the picture. And she very much took God out of the picture. As she says here, you can be agnostic. You know, these things tie together when you read her quote in Christian News, November 11th, 1985, said, quoting her, "The dying, the crippled, the mentally ill, the unwanted, the unloved, they are Jesus in disguise. Through the poor people, I have an opportunity to be 24 hours a day with Jesus." And so she even had this weird view that they were Jesus, not just their suffering, but, and it even talked about when they died, God died. I mean, she wasn't a good Roman Catholic, just for clarity. She was a bad Roman Catholic.
Or maybe the best. $100 million a year.
Oh, that's true. When if it's worship of money, she's pretty good.
And some of this is kind of a misapplication of that verse where Christ says, "If you as you do unto the least of these, my brethren, you do it unto me." But Christ is talking about something very specific there, and it doesn't mean he's saying you shouldn't help the poor and the sick. But he's being, but he is not saying that every person that is poor or sick is him.
And what it's definitely not saying is that you see Christ in them, you see God. This is the way to see who God is right. By their suffering. Because it's saying the mentally ill, the crippled, the unwanted, the unloved. If you're saying that's how you see Christ, so you're saying Christ is crippled, he's unwanted, he's unloved. I mean, this yes, Christ did this. He is sovereign over all things. But you don't look at the suffering that's in this world because of sin and say, therefore I see Christ. And that's what she was saying.
The sad thing is that some of these quotes sound like things, this one in particular, sounds like things that evangelicals might say coming back from a mission trip, which is not to justify Mother Teresa, but to say, you know, evangelicals.
They wouldn't say it in these many words, but they'd say it with these ideas.
I think they've heard pretty close to this.
I've heard very close to this. I mean, and it is that misapplication of that passage where Christ talks about that. And I mean, this comes down to proper handling of Scripture, handling of Christ's words, what is meant by it. And so, I mean, I think there are real bad theology hurts people.
I mean, I think where you get this from is even Matthew 5:3. You know, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. She dropped in spirit. She's saying the poor are blessed. And so this is the picture of heaven. This is how you see who Christ is. This is how you see who God is. Instead of saying this is how you see the effects of the curse in the world. And yes, God in his mercy lets people overcome that. He lets them persevere through it. But that's a picture of cursing, not a picture of how God is working in the world. This is how sin is working in the world.
Because when we see people suffering, I mean, well, it's right to help them and try to cure them, not let them have a glorious death. But spiritually, we should be reminded of the seriousness of sin and that there's a judgment day that we will all stand before God and give an account. And some of us, you know, or some of mankind will endure a lot worse than what you can endure on earth. And so it should make us fear God, not say God doesn't matter. This person practically is God because of how much they're suffering. It's just very twisted. And, you know, we all need to make sure that when we are in these tough situations, we don't go to platitudes because, you know, this is also the type of thing that like liberal Christians love to say and all. And it's misapplying the scripture. It's just going to making ourselves feel better, making the people who are not well feel, you know, just say anything to make them feel better. It's just destructive to everyone.
And too often they're not actually trying to help the people. And, you know, I'll get in a slam for, you know, evangelical mission trips. People send missionaries to go to like a country like Haiti or a country like, you know, I've heard the Bahamas and all these other countries, and they go there and build a church. There's lots of laborers that are unemployed in those countries that would love a job of building a church. So you have a choice. You get a bunch of teenagers that don't know what they're doing to spend a lot of money to fly them down there to pay 10 times what it would cost for local labor to do it. Or do you build the church? It's all fake. So much of our mission trips are just totally fake. They're just like Mother Teresa.
They're experiential.
They're about an experience. They're about seeing the poor. It's about, oh, look at how great we are. Look, we went and helped the poor. Well, take a tenth of that money and give it to a laborer, and they'll produce 10 times what you produce because you don't know what you're doing, and you'll actually have a church for a lot less money. But the point isn't the church. The point is you're buying, you know, it's misotourism. It's all just about having a touristic sense of, oh, I went to this neat place, and therefore I saw God, and I saw God at work. You didn't see God at work. You just saw poor stewardship.
So some of the quotes we read a moment ago from Mother Teresa sounded pretty, you know, secular almost, that, you know, religion doesn't even matter. But, you know, if we can also criticize her because she did articulate heretical Catholic doctrine. These are some points that she made in October 1984 at a worldwide retreat for priests. At the word of a priest, that little piece of bread becomes the body of Christ, the bread of life. Without a priest, without Jesus going with them, our sisters couldn't go anywhere. When the priest is there, then can we have our altar and our tabernacle and our Jesus. Only the priest put Jesus there for us. Jesus wants to go there, but we cannot bring him unless you first give him to us. This is why I love priests so much. We could never be what we are and do the things we do without you priests who first bring Jesus to us. Mary is our patroness and our mother, and she is always leading us to Jesus. And so, you know, we don't.
But she can't do it unless the priests are there.
Yeah, it's, you know, our, you know, now there's a question of what did she actually believe when she's speaking to priests. She's articulating this Orthodox Catholic doctrine when she's putting out a book that a lot of people from a lot of religions are going to read. Suddenly religion doesn't matter. What did she actually believe? But this is not good. This is pretty bad. And we don't have time to break down, you know, the biblical proof for all of these things. But, you know, this is standard, you know, horrible Catholic theology.
Transubstantiation and the priesthood, right? Secular sacred distinction. God says that we're all kings and priests, and they're eliminating that. They're saying you can't come to Jesus without the Roman Catholic Church. And I think the commonality between those two is this is fundraising. You need the priest. The priest should go out there and say, you need us. You need to give us money because you need us. You can't come to Jesus without us. And when she's writing the secular book to the secular world, she's going, I'm just making people a better people. Give me money. And so all of it seems to come back to give me money.
Some of the quotes I was reading, I was surprised how much she was saying Jesus, because I think at least some Catholics don't talk about Jesus all that much in terms of like praying to Jesus. But again, what audience was she talking to? Because I was reading other quotes where she's talking about praying to saints, praying to the Pope. She was even saying that, well, you know, the last few weeks I've been in a lot of peace because I started praying to just this Pope who had just died. I mean, very, very wrong to be idolizing this Pope, to be worshiping the Pope, the guy you knew a few weeks ago. He was, or a few, I don't know how long it was, but you knew him and now he's dead and you're praying to him. That's pretty, pretty horrible. And it even went further where, this was from kind of a throwaway quote that Christopher Hitchens toured one of her facilities, I think in India with her. Mm-hmm. And she walked into the room and, you know, the people in the room came and kissed her feet. And Hitchens is like, well, I'm not making too big of a deal out of this because this is probably a, you know, an Indian cultural thing, which it is an Indian cultural thing to honor people. Even your parents, you go, you kiss their feet or touch their feet. But she's supposed to be a Christian. And the Bible clearly says you don't worship people. You don't bow down. Angels appear to people in the Bible. The people bow down and the angels say, stand up. Don't worship me. And she's letting people worship her. Now, for a Catholic, it makes sense because people, I think even the Pope may have called her.
You have to kiss the ring.
Yeah, and the Pope may have called her a living saint. Everybody knew she's going to be a saint. People are going to pray to her. Let's go ahead and start it now. But if you're saying, is she a Christian? She is letting people worship her. The testimony, the first thing a Christian should do when they're going to India is like, stop worshiping me. Even though maybe you don't think it's worship, but bowing down is inherently worshipful in that context. So, she's letting people worship her is pretty bad.
And I do think, I mean, you were talking about how she was talking about the peace that she had from praying with the Pope. One thing that happened is after she died, she in her will said, all my letters must be destroyed. Any personal correspondent must be destroyed after I die. But the Pope said, wait a second, she's going to become a saint. And if she's saints, these are now relics that we can sell for a lot of money. And so you can't destroy any relics for a priest or for a saint because they're worth money. Churches pay a lot of money to have a relic in their church. And so the Pope said, no, it doesn't matter that she demanded that they all be destroyed. You're not destroying any of her letters. These are relics from a saint, even though she wasn't a saint yet. And so we have some letters some people went through them. And these letters talk of a very different person than the person that was, you know, that you hear going, oh, I have such peace because I prayed to the Pope. You know, like here's one. I spoke as if my very heart was in love with God, tender personal love, she wrote to one advisor. If you were there, you would have said, what hypocrisy. Because the person she was writing to knew that she didn't even really have faith. It was all fake. It was all just this, you know, she didn't love God. You know, another quote, please pray especially for me that I may not spoil his work and that our Lord may show himself. For there is such terrible darkness within me, as if everything was dead, she wrote in 1953. It has been like this more or less from the time I started the work. She never had any sense of knowing God. She never had any peace with God. Her letters throughout her life reflect this. There is one point in time where she starts to talk about having peace, But in general, she had no sense of knowing God at all. It was all, she puts on this facade, she puts on this thing, but in her private letters, she's openly saying, I'm dead inside.
And maybe you might point out, well, weren't there Puritans who struggle with assurance of salvation and weren't there, and they were Christians, but they were, you know, having these same thoughts perhaps. But one thing is she was in a religion that was not, that doesn't have the true gospel. So it's not a surprise that she has these problems. And the thing is too,
the other difference is the Puritans were being open and honest about it. The Puritans that struggle with that, they're publishing this publicly, typically. She was a complete hypocrite. She was saying one thing about how she was just seeing Christ and worshiping Christ and doing all this stuff. And then in private correspondence, she's saying none of that's true. I don't think you see nearly the same level of hypocrisy. There can be lack of assurance of salvation. People can be saved and not have assurance of salvation. Being a hypocrite's a different issue.
And people, Protestants like to say, well, some Catholics are saved. Even if the church is apostate, there's some Catholics who are saved. You know, and so shouldn't Mother Teresa be on the list? But she's not just a Catholic who did a lot of good works. I mean, well, we're talking about a lot of problems with her. But she started an order of nuns. She's leading people to Catholicism. She's letting people worship her. I mean, she's not speaking out about any of this Catholic doctrine. She, you know, if she's a Christian, who couldn't be? The people following her? Because people are like, well, the Pope, he must be a very spiritual man. He's probably saved. But so where's the people in here that aren't saved? The bottom ignorant people, they're obviously fine. Mother Teresa, the Pope, they're fine. Like, you literally, everyone in between's okay. I mean, we have to make a line somewhere that if you're in a false church, following a false gospel, starting new orders of a false church, we can't be saying you're all saved.
And there's no question she believed in works-based righteousness. For all the talk about Jesus, and there was some talk, some not talk, depending on the audience she was talking to. But if you go back to her book, the Christian way has always been to love God and one's neighbor as oneself. This is the introduction to it. Yet Mother Teresa has, perhaps with the influence of the East, distilled 6 steps to creating peace in ourselves and others that can be taken by anyone, even someone of no religious beliefs or of a religious background other than Christian, with no insult to beliefs or practices. This is why when reading Mother Teresa's words and those of her community, we may, if we choose, replace the references to Jesus with reference to other godheads or symbols of divinity. And she says you can earn salvation, which she refers to as peace, by starting with silence, with prayer, with faith, with love, with service, and that will result in peace. That it is your work, what you choose to do, is how you will have peace with God. She was 100% works-based. So if you think she's saved, you have to reject the gospel because Christ says you're saved not by works, but by faith. She did not believe that in any way, shape, or form.
There's no way to the Father except through the Son.
And she's going, there's another way. I can work out my salvation and actually produce salvation from it. And because it's you producing it, it doesn't matter if you call him Buddha. It doesn't matter if you call him Allah. It doesn't matter if you call him Jesus. It doesn't matter if you say he's a lamp. It doesn't matter. It's your works that will save you. That's what Mother Teresa believed.
And speaking of works, I mean, there's the Catholic Church has long had a problem of boosting up, I mean, much like the Pharisees, boosting up fake works and covering up serious sin. And this is something that she was very much caught up in. Her confessor and I think spiritual director of the order of nuns that she started was a child molester. He was a leading Jesuit priest. He was later convicted of it and sent to prison for decades. And this was something that was, it's pretty well documented. This was known about in the upper echelons of the Catholic Church. She knew about it. She knew about the accusations. And she sends a letter saying, we have to make sure this doesn't get out so that it doesn't, you know, bring bad repute on the priesthood. I mean, that is just wicked.
She doesn't want to expose the hidden works of darkness, which is what the commandment from Scripture is.
And she's head of this huge organization with orphanages. She doesn't care. She's not investigating.
In what, like 55 countries too? It wasn't just in India. It was by then that it had spread out quite a bit.
And I think this is part of it where people, people, again, don't realize when they think about charitable organizations, when they think about, when you look at somebody who says they're going to go and do X, Y, or Z, most people don't believe in sin. They don't actually believe that sin actually exists.
Well, they don't believe in the power of sin. That's
what I mean by, that's what I'm saying, is if you believe in sin without recognizing the power of it, you don't actually recognize and understand what sin is. And so you think of it being this thing in the world that people, like, they stumble into. They make a mistake here and there. But in the end, you're either a slave of sin or you're a slave of righteousness. And it doesn't mean that everybody who's a slave of sin can't be constrained, so they can't do anything that's good ever. You can make it so that they enjoy getting praise for good works. I mean, that can happen. But in the end, they're driven by something. And so there's this part of where I think when people look at Mother Teresa, they just don't realize that she was driven by the sin in her life. She was driven by sin, and it explains her life. And I think there's this part of it where when people go and when you just want to give money, you're basically just throwing it into a scenario where you don't know whose sin is being facilitated. And I mean, there's this part where we talked about, if somebody wanted to give $1 million here, I wouldn't recommend someone to just come and give $1 million without knowing real things.
Especially without some kind of, here's exactly what it's going to be spent on. And when you're ready to spend it on that, you give it, so you dole it out, so it's controlled, so you're making sure that it goes where it's supposed to go. I mean, it's
right. You're just being irresponsible.
And the reality is, if you don't do that, you end up facilitating sin.
We got a lot of comments from people coming in after we did the VOM episodes asking, where can I give my money? Because in the end, what people are doing is going, hey, you found a problem area, so where is somewhere good? And the answer, what we pretty much give, is you should be in a church that's trying to actively do things, and where you can be a part of that ministry, where you can have some connection, where you are just a step or two removed from the work being done, so that you can actually give accountability to it, that you can give an account to God and go, I put my money here, I took the things that you've given me, and I've done it, and I didn't just throw it to somebody and go, I hope they do the right thing with it.
I mean, when you look at all the churches, like at the, you know, in the 19th century, they were all gathering together to send out missionaries. And that was a really destructive thing for the missionary movement in so many ways, because it used to be a church would send out a missionary, in that they'd be contacting them and they'd be supporting them. And they'd, you know, now you look at it, when you get sent out by one of these denominational missionary organizations, almost nobody has real accountability to them. People don't go, we have a responsibility to visit them and make sure that we know that they're working and what they're doing. And it's very different if you get sent by a church than if you get sent by one of these denominations, because people aren't tracked the same way. And people need real accountability, because everybody has a tendency to sin, and everybody needs to have light, so that light causes the darkness that's in all of us, because we all have an old man that we're supposed to be putting to death. And that light actually helps us put that old man to death. And if you put somebody in darkness, you should expect the darkness to overtake them.
But, and when you look at it though, there's people who are trying to do the right thing through the system they set up, but it is not helping that much. And there's people who have set up the system, and it's, their motivations are a lot more questionable.
And I think when you look at Mother Teresa and the amount and the notoriety or the fame that she got.
The podcast hasn't been put out yet. She doesn't have the notoriety.
I was about to say, she should have notoriety, but because people haven't checked on her, she has a great deal of fame. And that fame means that she generated a huge amount of money, and that she could work to generate more money whenever she wanted to. And so, as you said before, that money went someplace. So when you look at what she's doing, she's not spending it over there. And again, I don't think she was spending it personally, but it became a money-making racket as opposed to actually something that helps the poor. And I think that's very common in the Roman Catholic Church, is that they take all these offerings. And I mean, I, you know, grew up Roman Catholic, and you see them take all these offerings, and I always went, really? They're doing this all over the world, and they're doing this little tiny thing. The numbers just don't add up. And that's kind of the case with her. The numbers just don't add up. She's taking $100 million in a year is what the estimate was. She helped, the estimate is 2 million people over a lifetime. Well, I'm sorry, those, I mean, 2 million people at $35 a year, which is what she said it costs to feed people, that you could help those, you could help more than 2 million people every single year. And she didn't help 2 million people every year. That was the total over her whole lifetime. And so the numbers don't come close to adding up, especially when you look at the level of care that she gave.
And the thing is, too, you know, it seemed like there was a big layer of just this deception in how they would run things. And some of this is deception that she did not come up with, but it, the Catholic Church had been doing for 1,000 years, which, so the order of nuns, I think one of their, you know, vows was a vow of poverty. So some of the orders in the Catholic Church, you promise to be poor, which means that someone donated like a mansion or a nice house to be some sort of center. I think in the U.S., I think it was. And so they strip out the carpets, they throw out the furniture and make it very Spartan and bare inside. Well, come on. It's a, you don't want, you can't have carpets because you're the poor nuns. Yeah, that's pretty, pretty ridiculous. And it's worse too, because so they, at a lot of the places where they're ministering to people, they aren't even being funded. It's volunteers helping. The things they're getting, the things they're giving out to people are things that are in-kind donations. So like, you know, you, there's a, an account of, you know, one of the, a soup kitchen, and they don't have bread that day. So they go out, and I think this was when it was smaller, so I think Mother Teresa was personally in charge of this, if I remember correctly. So that she sends people out to go to talk to the baker and say, "You, we need bread. This is a soup kitchen. We need free bread." And they don't give her bread, because their order, they were sold or whatever it was. And so she's like, "Well, we're not having bread. I'm not going to go buy bread. I have money in the bank account. I'm not buying bread. God didn't give us bread today." Because she had this kind of the George Mueller idea of God's going to provide every day.
Only with the wicked
with
element.
With a million dollars in the bank account. You can't do
millions.
That. Yeah, millions. Yeah. To be conservative, $1 million in the bank account. You can't say, "I need provision every day. Let's see what God sends," when he is sending you $1 million.
It's that old story of the person in the flood and the, you know, this right. boat comes by and this, they, God's going to help me. And I sent all these other things, right? I
mean, it's, right. It's but it's all about the ridiculous. It's all about the poverty. Right. This is, you know, we're poor people. We're just doing our best to help people. We need, we, you know, I, she says, "I never ask for money. If people want to give me money, that's on them. I will tell people, like, you're, the people at the soup kitchen are starving if you don't give us bread, but I'll never ask for anything." Very.
And you know, when you go back to the time of the Reformation, there were lots of monasteries that had taken vows of poverty. And I think the estimate was that 70% of the wealth in Scotland was in those monasteries, because the people had personal poverty, but most of them still lived pretty luxurious lives, even though personally they had sworn to poverty. And because they didn't own anything, because the monastery owned everything. So they had a, you know, which means the Roman Catholic Church has the ability to get money from them whenever they want, because the monastery owns everything. So people take a vow of poverty. It doesn't mean they live an impoverished life. What it means is they don't own anything. Now, in some cases, they were a lot more serious about it than others. But historically, that's what these you know, denominations of monks did, is that they collected huge amounts of money. And that's what she did.
And she has very much, she had a carefully crafted public persona. You know, it's just the fact of a matter. She doesn't want press, but she always invites the press to come along with her everywhere. I mean, just so many things like that. And how she dealt with a lot of the criticism that she had is like, Christopher Hitchens made this movie about her, which I haven't seen it. There's probably good stuff and there's probably bad stuff. But her response is, "I forgive him." Like, okay, answer the criticisms. You know, say you're right on this, you're wrong on this. But no, she takes this higher saintly, quote unquote, attitude of, I'm just going to be the better person and just forgive you. I don't even need to answer. I'm so self-justified, self-evidently by what I'm doing. And just, that's not a Christian way to handle accusations, to just say, "I forgive you."
And I mean, as you listen to this, it just keeps striking me over and over again that the modern church does not think, I mean, God warns us. The Jews were destroyed because they had a form of godliness but denied the power thereof. That's exactly what Mother Teresa was. She didn't have any power. She didn't have any power to have herself have peace, even though she's writing books about how to have spiritual peace. She doesn't have any. And so she's writing all these things, and she has this form of godliness, but there's no power of godliness in her life. She's not testifying to a God that's powerful. She's not testifying, hey, we can raise these people out of poverty. It's that we can watch them suffer and help them continue their suffering in poverty. Because even when she would feed them, she would just, I mean, she, you know, the old saying is, right, if you give somebody a fish, you fed them for a day. If you teach them how to fish, you feed them for their lifetime. She never taught anybody to fish. Her view was always, I just feed them today, and that's it, so that I can get the cameras, I can get the people to know, I can get publicity, I can get all these people
to, so I can see them suffer.
So that I can see them suffer, and then I can see Christ. And it's not alleviating poverty. She perpetuated poverty.
Really? No, when you think about that, it's a form of exploitation of those people, because if you're just letting them suffer so that you can get this perceived benefit of, even if it's bringing you closer to God, it's almost like they're her sacrifice to bring her closer to God or something.
Right. I mean, it's just, and her picture is, I'm the living sacrifice. But the reality is she wanted the poor to be a sacrifice for her.
I mean, I think part of it, as you've been talking, what's interesting to me is, because as you've been mentioning this, you've mentioned it a couple times, there's aspects of evangelical Christianity that has a compatible view of how to help others in a sense. And what's interesting is, like, when you say, like, raising them out of poverty, I don't think that people frequently immediately connect that to the coming of the gospel. And there's this,
which they should, because poverty in the world has been so alleviated by the gospel.
And I think there is this real, because, you know, one of the marks of a false teaching is that they take spiritual things and they make them carnal. And you see this all throughout there, as we've been talking about it, as they turn all these carnal, spiritual things into carnal things. But there is a point where your theology meets flesh and blood. You know what I mean? How does it work out in the world?
The spiritual things affect physical
things.
Right,
and so the spiritual things shouldn't become physical, but they impact physical things. And I think in Christianity, we've really just lost the idea that what Christianity does is it brings order. It brings an emphasis on truth. It changes, it eliminates, like, bribery is one of the first things that goes away when Christianity starts coming to a culture, because people start, you know, that people
and
start
walking the light.
And so there's this part of it where it's so easy to go, Christianity is just this idea that you give people, you tell them about things. And I think that's at the heart of this, is one of the reasons why people don't see Mother Teresa the way they should, is because the church hasn't really been teaching what the gospel is and what it brings with it and what is necessary. Like, when you say godliness, that godliness comes with it. And that godliness is that people should, if someone wants to eat, they should work.
Right.
If someone, you know,
and you have a duty to facilitate their working. There's gleaning laws. You have a duty to go, okay, this person needs to work, so what can we do to teach them how to work so that they can provide for themselves, so that they get lifted out of poverty? Those are what the laws say. That's God's way. That's not Mother Teresa's way.
As we've gone into Nigeria, that's been one of the hardest aspects, is figuring out both that you want to preach the gospel, but then in your ministry there, you're trying to say, how do I establish principles so that the people that we bring in are taught what Christianity says must happen in the culture, what Christianity says must be true, that you have to change fundamental things about the culture. And I don't think she wasn't trying to fundamentally change the culture. She was just
trying to eliminate the people from dying on the streets. That's literally what she said her mission was. Not to stop them from dying, but to stop them from dying on the streets.
And if you just stuck to that, then we wouldn't be complaining about it.
But in the end, there still would be a problem.
But she still failed those people. But yeah, she wouldn't be world famous if that's all she did.
But in the end, that is all she did, except for the other lies. Right. It's the other things that she said she did, and it's the way that she said she did it, and it's why people wanted to give her money.
I do think, you know, and we should recognize, because I kind of said this about, you know, churches that, you know, we did a whole episode on what the statement of faith of VOM is, and you have churches that are faithful that they're giving to an organization that is not a Christian organization. Their statement of faith isn't Christian, but yet but yet people give it and they go, oh yeah, we're helping to spread the gospel. They're not helping spread the gospel. They're helping fight against the gospel when you give money to Voice of the Martyrs. But when you think about her receiving a Nobel Prize, we just need to understand how this even works in the world. That even unbelievers want, the people in the rich West are sitting there going, we've got all kinds of stuff. And you look at Calcutta, and Calcutta is an incredibly poor place in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. Like a poverty level that, you know, I think people on welfare in the United States, I know this was true like 20 years ago, people on welfare in the United States used to have a higher level of home ownership than people in Germany did. So this is how rich we are in the United States. And so there's this guilt that we're told to have. And even outside of the church, I'm just saying in America and in Europe, that there's this guilt that we have because we have all this money and there's all these people starving in the world. So Mother Teresa came in and went, I'm solving that problem. Just give me money. And the people went, great. We just write a check. And so I think even when you look at the, you know, it's pretty interesting to me because you look at the Nobel Peace Prize Committee, and they're pretty liberal. They're pretty anti-abortion, and they have been for a long
time.
Pro-abortion, they have been for a long time. And yet, here they are giving her an award. And I think in the end, what the award was is, hey, you make us feel less guilty about being rich. And so there was somebody that had a quote. I tried to find the quote, but basically said, yeah, she pretended like she was ministering to poor people, but who she was really ministering to was the Europeans, the wealthy Europeans and Americans, because they were the ones that were receiving peace from her. Because basically you give her money and now you can feel like, well, I've helped the poor in India.
Numerous other incidents that we haven't even touched on. But one is where there is a guy who had given Mother Teresa's organization a lot of money. And he later was found that he was running some sort of Ponzi scheme and went to prison. And she sent a letter saying, I don't know much about this guy, but I just know he's helped the poor and Jesus forgives. So I want, you know, maybe you'll forgive too, to the judge. And so then what an abdication of due diligence, my goodness. But then the DA sent a letter back saying, well, you know, to make a long letter short, he says, you know, one, he says, you know, indulgences since the Protestant Reformation have not been a way to have your sins forgiven. So sorry.
Not according to the Roman Catholic Church.
According to this guy. And he was right. You can't, just because this guy gave indulgences, paid you for indulgences, doesn't mean we should let him out of prison. But he says, if you care about helping poor people, I'll send you a list of all the money he stole from people. Return the money he gave.
Who lost their retirement funds, their life savings.
So these people are now poor, and you had stolen goods given to you. And I don't know if it was public, but she had the money in the bank account, and she doesn't even respond. She's above criticism. She's a living saint. Yeah, she forgave him.
She forgave him for, yes. And so, I mean, just this whole, you know, we should just recognize how often we do this, where we'll elevate people, right? This, you can look at it with Mother Teresa helping the poor. You look at it with missionaries. You send out missionaries where you go, well, I don't need to go witness because I'm paying for this missionary to go witness. And we should just be really careful about when we raise up these stars and even the mega church pastors. The reality is, you know, Hebrews 5, not many of you are teachers. Excuse me, not Hebrews 5. Why aren't you teachers yet? You know, and we go, oh, we don't need to be teachers. We have so-and-so who has a church of 25,000. We don't need to teach. We should recognize the issue with Mother Teresa is rampant through the church and is widely accepted in the church. We have the same problem in a whole bunch of different areas, where instead of actually saying, no, Christ saved us to walk in the good works that he prepared beforehand for us to walk in. Instead of saying, that's why Christ saved us, we go, well, we just get money. We just delegate it. This guy will do it for me.
And another thing, too, is, you know, when the, because a lot of Christian leaders kind of embrace Mother Teresa, you know, supposedly sound people. And another thing is, too, like, they didn't need her to be exposed to know not to partner with her and not to sing her praises.
You mean because she was high up in the Roman Catholic Church?
Yeah. Consider that spiritual things are more important than physical things. So, you know, are there Catholics right now that are helping people? you know, in physical ways. I don't doubt that there are, you know, Catholic ministries that, you know, tomorrow some will go and really be helped physically by the Catholic Church. But I do not need to pat them on the back to partner with them. And I ought not to, because spiritual things are more important. And if they are leading people to hell, why would I partner with someone just because they're popular?
And this includes on abortion, because the pro-life movement is largely driven by Catholics and not by evangelicals, not by people who actually have the true gospel. And you see the movement. I mean, I've seen it over my life, is there's been a movement where it's like, well, let's not preach the gospel. Well, that's the Roman Catholic influence. The reality is, it's more important that the woman, as important as it is to save that baby, it's more important for the woman to know she's going to hell. It's more important for her to know that even as wicked as she is, after just aborting the baby, after just murdering her child, the grace of Christ is sufficient. He can forgive. And we can make it about the baby instead of about eternal life. That's just physical life. There's more important things.
Yeah, it's the type of thing where we can have a balance and say, well, we're glad that they are against abortion.
Yes.
But we don't need to minister with them. You know, maybe even we're, you know, because we go to abortion clinic, and there's Catholics out there. You know, am I going to tell them to go home? Probably not. But I'm not going to say I'm on the same team as you.
One other thing that is worth, you know, now she's no longer, we call her Mother Teresa, which is still a horrible name. Yeah, we use the term because that's what she's known for, but obviously she's now a saint. And when you look at the way she became a saint, it's just about money grubbing. It's just about the Roman Catholic Church wanting to use her, right, to be a saint. To be beatified, you have to have one miracle, and to be canonized, to be a saint, you have to have two miracles. I mean, her miracles, like one of them was that somebody was in remission from their, I think it was leukemia, because of their drugs. And they went, oh, it's because she prayed to Mother Teresa. So this is how she, in, it's supposed
they
to be five
a beam
years.
Of light came off of the thing and struck her. And like I said, she was in remission when supposedly it happened. And so.
And like her husband said, it wasn't true, and
right.
And nobody cared. Right. By Vatican rules, you have to wait 5 years. They bypassed that because they wanted her to be this thing that they could sell these relics for, that they could make money off of. They could do all the things that they usually do. So we just need to recognize. You go, oh, she's Saint Teresa. Sainthood means nothing in Roman Catholicism. It's all fake. The reality is, what saint means is one who has been sanctified by the work of Christ. That was not Mother Teresa. Too often the church ignores what Christ said when he said we should be wise as serpents and gentle as doves. And instead we hear people that we know that they hold to a false religion. We know that they aren't doing what they should be doing. We know we have no reason to believe they're right with God, but yet we'll think that we should give them money and just treat them without any judgment whatsoever. We do this over and over again. People have, even those who are saved, they still have sin in them that God in his mercy is cleansing. And so we shouldn't just blindly trust anybody. Thanks for joining us.
This has been The Conquering Truth, a project of Reformation Baptist Church. If you found this helpful, you can visit us online at theconqueringtruth.com and subscribe here or in your favorite podcast app. Thanks for watching.